Nature doesn't do to us will be done by our fellow man. The little ditty which Charlotte Ray has sung for us is a byproduct of a modern American phenomenon known as black humor. It can be argued there is not much new about black humor except the label itself and the packaging. Its characteristic note of mockery, nihilistic laughter, and outrageous ribaldry has sounded through literature since Thersites mocked the pompous Greek heroes of the Trojan War. Humor in varying shades of black is woven through American fiction since 1850. Mark Twain in some of his works, and Ambrose Bierce in all of his, played wittily with the powers of darkness. Hardly anyone pigeonholes Melville and Hawthorne among our humorists, but they both mingle strains of jet black, rebellious farce with the solemnity of their major works. And after them, Sherwood Anderson and Faulkner found in American grotesqueries a vision in which the enduring social pieties were distorted in a wild, black mingling of pity and laughter. Nathaniel West, S.J. Perelman, and Erskine Caldwell were among the black humorists of the 1930s. Indeed, there might turn out to be more ancestors than descendants if we put the names of the present black humor stars in a literary perspective, or if we counted them as part of a general fashion in the entertaining and popular arts, as literary counterparts of comedians like Mort Sahl, cartoonists like Charles Adams, the creators of insult greeting cards or of television's monster comedies, they would appear in an even smaller minority. Nevertheless, the swelling mood of black humor appears to be the most notable fictional phenomenon of the 60s. Black humor is no man's copyright. A dazzling range of contemporary sensibilities can be fairly viewed as part of the phenomenon if we as readers look for it beyond the all too facile tags of identification. Two recent novels which have caused an unusual stir in the literary world are Stern and A Mother's Kisses. They are the work of a brilliant novelist whose short stories are collected in the volume Far From the City of Class, Bruce J. Friedman.
Black humorist, Jewish intellectual, Southern school, urban school. I think writers tend to get nervous when they're put into categories and groupings. Yet I think they get twice as irritated when they're left out of them. As for black humor, by this time it has a kind of tired sound to it, to me, like last year's beer commercials. What remains true is that if there is any black humor, then the Bible and main source of it is still the New York Times. We hail forth a new leader in Vietnam, our one golden hope in Asia, Marshall Key. With enormous pride, he announces that the man he admires more than anyone else in history is Adolf Hitler. Elsewhere, some top Air Force officers are angry because North Vietnam is too poor a country to have any really juicy bomber targets. In France, General de Gaulle cancels his 20-year-old annual ceremony honoring Yanks who died liberating France, and then announces that this is not to be construed as an anti-American act. In this country, a supposedly dead woman begins to stir with life, and she's rushed from the morgue back to the hospital. Back at the morgue, the shocked attendant is interviewed and says, "Thank God she didn't fully recover in a place like this. Lord alone knows what would have happened then." It confirms your belief that a new and powerful chord of absurdity has been struck in the land, that there is a new mutative style of behavior afoot, one that can only be dealt with by a new one-foot-in-the-asylum style of fiction. What's happened is that the journalist who's had to cover the world of the 60s has become today's satirist, and the novelist, satirist, the ground snatched from beneath his feet by today's Jack Ruby-esque style of public absurdity, has had to make an attempt to discover new territory, invent a new currency, new filters for his vision, has had to sail into darker waters somewhere beyond conventional satire. And this may or may not be a definition of black humor. Whatever the case, it's the last you're going to hear on this subject from me. At my end, I like to tell stories, have some fun, get people to read them, and then tell some more. And I can't imagine spending my time doing anything else.
To discuss the work of Bruce J. Friedman and the black humor movement in general, we have the distinguished literary critic and novelist, Leslie A. Fiedler, many of whose works have become modern classics. His latest novel is The Last Jew in America. Our other guest is George Mandel, whose first novel, Flee the Angry Strangers, helped initiate the beat movement in fiction. He's a close observer of the trends in the modern American novel. We may agree that the impulse that results in black humor is a kind of reaction to the anxieties and the disorders of the 60s. At the same time, we haven't lived in a very comfortable or orderly century, and I wonder if earlier decades of this century have not had comparable reactions that emerged in fiction. Wasn't the beat movement in fiction, of which you were a part, a reaction against the disorder of the bomb and the alienation that followed the war?
Yes, I think it was very much similar in that respect. We were responding to World War II and the specter of the atom bomb, and looking around at what we were seeing, writing about our environment, which seems to be what the black humorists are doing now.
You went on the road.
On the road.
But they're laughing, they're mocking more than the beats were.
Well, there was a lot of humor in the so-called beat generation too, but right, there was a lot of horror, a horror reaction.
Behind it all.
Behind it all,
yes. Leslie, what would you say about the 30s, the time when Hitler was coming up and the Depression had shaken American confidence? Was there a comparable reaction in literature against these disorders?
Well, surely there was. I mean, all you have to do is think of Nathaniel West or Daniel Fuchs, for instance, and you realize that at that moment, people were responding in a way which is somewhat like the thing we're talking about now. That is to say, without denying the grimness of life, they were suggesting that the only proper response was laughter. But there seems to me an even more important and consequential difference between the two periods, which is based on the fact that in the 30s, for instance, everybody was responsible politically, and yet nobody could foresee anything but failure, personal or communal and collective. Whereas the period out of which Well, black humor comes as a period of relative prosperity, great prosperity, extensive prosperity, and yet people realize that with everybody making it and the irresponsible setting the tone to the age, things are just as bad or maybe a little bit worse or at least as absurd. And I don't think it's an accident, say, that Daniel Fuchs's books are set in the tenements of Williamsburg and that Stern, for instance, the book about which we're talking, takes place in well-to-do suburbia.
Yes, the protest novel has very little to do with the black humor novel.
The black humor novel is a novel of non-protest, exactly, or anti-protest.
Protest having become absurd, perhaps.
Well, one more absurdity in
another
a world of absurd things.
Another absurdity in many. Yes, I see. In 1962, Bruce J. Friedman published the highly provocative novel Stern, which is possibly his best-known work. Stanley Edgar Hyman wrote at that time that Friedman is greatly gifted, fiercely honest, and very welcome news indeed. We will hear a synopsis of the novel, specially prepared for this program.
Paul Round-Shouldered Stern was a man with pale, spreading hips. He came from the city with his family to suburbia. His child, a lonely boy, sucked on blankets. His wife, equally lonely, took up modern dance. Shortly after their arrival, the first of several terrors struck. A caterpillar army came and attacked the grounds. They ate approximately half of everything, each shrub, each bush. Despite Stern's chemical counterattack, the caterpillars prevailed. His lawn became a cancer garden. Stern found he had a nemesis, a strongly built, T-shirted, heavy-armed neighbor who forbade his child from playing with Stern's boy. And worst of all, the man had pushed down Stern's wife. Soon, Stern was a troubled man, another terror, the dog escort situation. Every day when Stern walked home from the train station to his house, he had to cross a rather large estate. Immediately, two thin, huge dogs would vault a fence and make for him with a whistling sound. One took Stern's wrist between his teeth, and the two animals, hugging close to his side, walked in between them, as though they were guards taking a man to prison. Still, Stern tried to love and nurture his suburban home, but his wife lamented, "What am I going to do out here?" And when Stern had gotten past the dogs, he would find his son standing in the middle of the lawn, holding his blanket, as though he'd been there all day waiting for Stern to come back. The bloom was definitely off the rose. But the encounter his wife had had with a thick-armed man troubled him the most. This preoccupation became more and more an obsession. He would often make his wife act out the pushing down scene. Sometimes he would take her part in the tableau. This exercise strangely inflamed him. Why was his obsession with the man somehow centered on his hugely thick arms? He had reveries about them, even remembering that his baseball heroes of the past, Charlie Keller, Dolph Camilli, Johnny Mize, they all had in common hugely thick arms. Why hadn't he confronted the man? His whole experience in suburbia soon became unbearable, and this in turn created yet another terror, this time a tangible, material something. Stern got an ulcer, and he visualized it as a mean little animal with a hairy face, coarse-tufted, angry. His boss, the fabulously wealthy Mr. Bella Vista, sympathized so with him and his ulcer that he announced magnanimously, "I'm continuing your salary while you're away, for as long as it takes. I don't care if it's 3 weeks." So Stern and his ulcer came home. His father was a shoulder pad maker who always wore a slip-over sweater. His strange Uncle Babe, usually around, was always thinking he noticed a subtle fishy smell. And above all, his all-pervasive mother. His mother, an aging sex pot in Toreador pants. The news of Stern's ulcer precipitated, of all things, a family concert. Stern didn't feel any better when later that same night he saw his wife coming home from the dance class, kiss her instructor goodbye. Very fervently, he thought. She protested, "Kissing is a showbiz thing." So Stern went to a rest home. Everyone there seemed to be doomed, grotesquely, hideously doomed. It was a grand guignol sort of a home. Yet it fulfilled him in a way for the first time, for he built a kinship with some of the hopelessly ill inmates, even relishing a grisly sexual encounter with a bedraggled amateur prostitute. Stern was one of the boys. Out of the rest home, Stern came back to the old agonies, above all, the persecutions of the neighborhood. And after coming close, so close to collapse, he knew that once and for all, he had to face up to his nemesis with the thick arms or go under. Came the apocalyptic confrontation. "You're the man who said kike to my wife. You shouldn't say that. And we're gonna fight." It wasn't much of a fight. He felt exhilarated, however, but strangely disappointed that his nemesis hadn't killed him, though one punch almost severed his ear. He had faced destruction, the abyss, trial by fire, and survived. With great emotion and perhaps new strength, he knelt beside his sleeping boy and said, "I feel like doing some hugging." His wife came in too, and it occurred to him that he would like to try something a little theatrical. Just kneel there quietly with his arms protectingly draped around his wife and child. He tried it, and wound up holding them a fraction longer than he'd intended.
It occurs to me that what we now call black humor in fiction may be a sort of popularization of ideas and visions that have been apprehended by writers throughout this century. For instance, the central situation in Stern, his problem with his wife and the man who pushed her down, strikes me as being very much like the situation in James Joyce's Ulysses. In the Night Town scene, you know, Leopold Bloom does have some thoughts about the relation between his wife Molly and Blazes Boylan. And also the earlier bit, the encounter with the anti-Semite, is in some ways a parallel between the fight between Bloom and the citizen in the bar in an earlier episode of Ulysses. Do you see these extensions of modern black humor running back into literary history?
Well, I see them going back at least as far as Joyce, and the two elements which you pick up out of Joyce are surely there. One is the burlesque element involved in both those episodes you talked about, and the other, and that seems to me even more important, is the insistence on the anti-heroic nature of the episode. That is, the encounter between a relatively good man, let's say Bloom for the sake of argument, and a really wicked one, the anti-Semite, instead of being rendered as pathetic or tragic or even melodramatic, is rendered as a kind of a joke, you know, because Bloom himself is downgraded, so.
And the pathos itself is incorporated in the sardonic note of the
whole. Right, but the one thing which is still present in Ulysses, and I don't think you have what I think of as black humor proper until this is gone, is a memory of a past tradition against which this is being measured. The very name of the book, Ulysses, is measuring these unheroes, non-heroes, anti-heroes, always against the heroic figures outside of the past. And the whole legend of Greece is still very much alive in the book. It's only played with ironically. But when that legend disappears, it isn't even evoked anymore, and all you have left is the burlesque and the anti-heroism, then I think you've come into the area of Stern proper.
Yes. I suppose that if we found black humor in Faulkner, we would also say that the present is set ironically against the image of the heroes of the past. Not mythological heroes there.
Well, but in terms of American mythology, the great Southern mythology of the Civil War, yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. But I toy with the idea also that there may be a sort of metaphysical extension in black humor, and in the work of someone like Flannery O'Connor, for instance, you find the central character being rendered absurd by his relation not merely to the social disorder around him, but to the very condition of man. And I suppose this is no unique theme in...
And surely in somebody like Flannery O'Connor, what you get is this the whole metaphysical business raised really to a religious level. That is, the confrontation between a man and the absurdity of his situation, his destiny, is finally in Flannery O'Connor, and that's where I think she passes out. I'm trying to narrow the tradition. Is finally rendered in Christian terms, or
yes,
extended in Christian terms. I don't know how you say it, but that is to say, as soon as you get the suggestion that this encounter is some way Christ-like or an imitation of Christ in one sense or another, then you're out of the world of black humor, which, from my point of view, is a nihilistic world. The only real analogs would be in the really bleak plays of Shakespeare's middle comedies, like Measure for Measure and Troilus and Cressida, for instance.
Yes. I wonder why we should narrow it in, though, instead of trying to expand out from the present scene into...
I suppose that's just the ignoble critic's concern for preserving the purity of his terms. You can throw it out if you don't like it.
Well, I like to see the atmosphere around the thing. I suppose, George, we can see relations between the fiction that's called black humor and a great many other things that are all around us in the air and in our hands.
Well, it relates to humor, and it's essentially a particular approach to humor, rather, to my mind, than an approach to the world. As Leslie suggested a while ago, it is a sort of... It is not a protest, but rather a disengagement.
And a disenchantment with it.
Beginning with a disenchantment,
yes.
It becomes, as you suggested, an anti-protest rather than a protest.
Yeah, well, do you see any connection between this and the sick jokes?
Yes, by all means.
And the wickedness of W.C. Fields.
It goes way back, and more recently than Fields, we had the, seems to be the origin of the sick joke in the Shaggy Dog stories of World War II, if you remember some.
Yes.
They were so ugly that they don't even bear repeating here.
Yeah.
And they were funny at the same time.
And you're a cartoonist, too. We've perhaps not mentioned Jules Pfeiffer and the bitter black cartoons that he draws and that you draw sometimes. Do you find there's a stylistic connection between black humor fiction and the simplifications of the cartoonist?
Absolutely. That's a perfect term for it. The simplification of life into laughable form rather than a form that one would react to with despair.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very cartoon-like...
No despair reaction. In black humor.
Bruce Friedman implies or says so, that there is no despair.
No despair.
Would you make a distinction between cool attitudes and black humorous attitudes?
Certainly.
In
this way, that black humor attitudes contain suffering, not despair, but the suffering is very obvious, whereas cool pretends a lack of suffering, an aloofness.
We've been talking so much about the atmosphere around black humor that perhaps we should ask Leslie to sum up what he feels to be the very special quality in black humor that distinguishes it from the satire of the past or other things in American literature that may have some similarities to it.
Yeah, well, I've begun to move in on this in various ways, but maybe it would pay at this point if I stepped back and came at the whole problem in a new direction and then maybe tried to close together some of the things, the ways in which we've been moving out. I think the one thing that we haven't talked about, which is always in my mind when I think about black humor, is its relationship to the, or I guess better, a Jewish tradition. It seems to me, especially if you're thinking of Stern and of Joseph Heller, for instance, and of the antecedents in the 1930s that we talked about before, Nathaniel West and Daniel Fuchs and so
Perlman,
forth.
And Perlman, perhaps.
And S.J. Perlman,
yes.
Surely. If you're thinking about those things, then what becomes apparent to you is that somewhere behind black humor, there lies the form, or especially the attitude or the tone of the Jewish joke.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of joke which is invented by Eastern European Jewry at its moment of intensest suffering, when the suffering was intense, that's the word which we found before, but there was no hope.
Yes.
If you get maximum suffering and minimum hope, then you get a kind of joke which on the one hand attempts to destroy through humor the world that oppresses and makes the Jew suffer.
A necessary joke.
A joke which you either make or choose silence.
Yes.
But on the other hand, a kind of joke which doesn't ennoble the teller of the joke against his victimizer,
yes,
doesn't make the victim seem nobler, but undercuts and mocks the victim at the same moment that it does the victimizer, until finally, you know, both are cut away and you're left with a great empty black hole into the center of the universe, at which point you either laugh or go mad. And I would suppose that black humor is a kind of humor which has, I think Bruce Friedman said in his introduction, 1 foot in the madhouse. I think I would say 2 feet in the madhouse, and maybe just the tip of the man's nose out of the window looking at another kind of world outside.
Mm-hmm. If the term black humor is to mean anything worth the reader's serious consideration, it must be a category large and flexible enough to contain elements emerging in the work of John Hawkes, Saul Bellow, and Norman Mailer. If J.P. Donlevy and Terry Southern are black humorists, as the popular magazines tell us they are, then whatever is worthwhile in their work will be broadened and stabilized by acquaintance with the black variations of James B. Hall and Kurt Vonnegut, Thomas Berger, Stanley Elkin, and Joseph Heller, and Lester Gorin belong in this spectrum. It's at least partly up to readers and critics to help defend the larger implications of black humor from the narrowness of commercial exploitation. I think it's still to be determined what black humor will finally amount to. Our conception of it may be narrowed so that it will soon appear to be a fad, sold like Batman by wily entrepreneurs taking advantage of the sick, undefended spots in our lives. Thank you.
But we can be thankful and tranquil and proud, for man's been endowed with a mushroom-shaped cloud. We know for certain that some lovely day someone will set the spark off, and we will all be blown away. They're rioting in Africa. Come on, everybody, sing! There's strife in Iran. Tra-la-la-la-la-la. What nature doesn't do to us will be done by our fellow man. La-la-la.